Hello, this is Frank Williams, otherwise known as the Reverend Timothy Farthing, Vicar of Warmington-on-Sea during the Second World War, and welcome to the Dad's Army Podcast.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run?
Welcome to episode 33 of the Dad's Army Podcast. This time round, it's an extremely special edition. Rather than just me, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other people joining me this time to discuss the sometimes controversial Dad's Army movie. I'm really pleased to welcome Tony back to the podcast. It's been nearly 9 months, Tony, since you've featured.
Could have had a baby in that time.
Great. Moving on, I'm really pleased to welcome our resident expert here at the podcast, Paul Carpenter from the Dad's Army Appreciation Society.
Hello there. Oh, I haven't been that long away from the podcast, have I?
Well, no, I think it's been a while since you've recorded with us, but you were featuring, I think, just a couple of episodes ago.
Branched out on my own.
I'm also really pleased to welcome James back to the podcast.
Hello there, yes, I've taken some time out of the podcast watching other programmes.
Other programmes?
Yes.
Okay, there are other programmes, are there?
There
apart
are.
From Dad's Army. And Claire, once again, making a regular appearance on the podcast, aren't you?
Oh, hello again. I'm worried about what accidental controversy I might be causing this time, but hello.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what controversy you can stir up. And all of us are extremely honoured and privileged to be joined this time by the Reverend Timothy Farthing, Frank Williams. Thanks for joining us once again, Frank.
Hello, good to be here once again. When I first did it, I didn't even know what a podcast was. I think I do now.
Can I just say thank you so much for spending some time with us this afternoon to record what I'm hoping is going to be an extremely interesting discussion.
Great pleasure.
Now, we've just spent the last 90 minutes watching the Dad's Army movie that was released on the 12th of March, 1971. 12th of March is my birthday, so
there you go.
What a coincidence.
1971.
I'm not that old. Frank, it must have been a very different experience recording or filming a film version of Dad's Army to that which you became used to after the film.
Well, of course, we'd done some of the television series before that, and it actually surprises me now to find that we actually did the film really quite early. Quite often when you do a film spin-off from a television series, it's after the series is over, but this was way back, well, not even halfway through in the very early days. Mm. But it was a great experience, and I loved it. And I think I got better paid than I did for the television.
What was your initial reaction when you found out that they wanted to make a film of Dad's Army?
Well, I thought it was going to be great fun. My great memory is arriving, my very first day of filming, arriving at Chalfont St Giles, which they used as the location, and getting there, the car delivered me rather early, and I remember thinking, oh, I'll have a wander around the village and see what it looks like, because I'd never been there before. And I wandered around, and I thought, my gosh, this is a really, really good choice, because this hasn't altered at all. Looking in these shop windows, they're still showing the stuff that they used to have during the war, and those advertisements. And it wasn't until I saw Walls stop me and buy one ice cream tricycle and park somewhere, I suddenly thought, no, of course they've dressed the whole village in order to make it right for the film. So there we are.
That kind of preempts my next question, Frank.
Sorry about that.
No, not in the slightest. No, it's just as well I'm so organised and professional a presenter.
Lucky that, yeah.
Yes. And Thetford, of course, was your regular haunt for location shooting, as it was throughout the whole of the 9-year run. What was it like, apart from your initial reaction that you've just described, to filming somewhere else?
And I suppose the reason for it was that it was much nearer London, and they didn't have to put us up in hotels and things, so they saved some money. It was great. I mean, it was a lovely, lovely place to do the filming, and it was great fun.
The direction, well, somewhat controversially, I think, not by David Croft or Hal Snow, but by Norman Cohen. What was it like being directed by somebody else other than those established directors?
I know that some people do feel the film direction was not, and having just watched it, I see what they mean. It's much slower in pace than the television series, and I think in a way, but it does have enormous charm, and it actually captures a feeling of wartime Britain. I'm the only person here actually who actually remembers it, and even I was only a schoolboy at the time, but it does actually capture something which I think is really, really good.
Certainly people have said that the film has got a certain charm about it, just a different charm to that which a TV series has, and some people that follow Dad's Army quite closely don't like the difference. They feel that the TV series is the definitive Dad's Army, and that the movie tried to rewrite some already classic episodes. How do you feel about the reinvention of the beginning of Dad's Army?
Well, I think the beginning, I think the opening sequence of the film where, you know, we're hearing Anthony Eden's broadcast. I have to be honest, I wasn't in the first two series of Dad's Army, so I don't really remember the early episodes, as it were, but I thought that was absolutely marvellous. Where it has actually taken up some of the sort of things that normally happen in the TV series, I don't think it works as well as the TV series. Corporal Jones constantly saying they don't like it up and so on doesn't seem to work quite so well as it did in the TV series. And we don't have any of Corporal Jones's long, rambling reminiscences of the Boer War and anything. And I think that's a shame. And where it just sort of... I think it was a pity, in a way, it used some of the things that had already been used or were about to be used in the television series.
Mm. I think this is something that we'll open up for discussion a little bit later on, but I'd be interested to know whether you think it was a good idea to reuse some of the things that had already been seen in the first couple of series.
No, I think it probably wasn't, in a way. I mean, I think... Now Jimmy and David are probably going to shoot me for this, but I think that, I mean, it would have been better to have a totally original script, so that it didn't... I mean, inevitably it was going to use some of the scenes, because, I mean, the formation of the Home Guard and the fact that they started off with broom handles and carving knives and so on was obviously going to be part of it, but... then I don't quite know why we had the things like using the van and the van being converted to gas and so on and so forth. Mm. It seemed to me that was, well, we'd seen it already, or if we I can't get it in order, we'd either seen it already, we're about to see it in a quick series soon. So, I think it would have been better not to have used any of the stuff that had been already in the TV series.
No, I think you're right. From a fan's point of view, certainly watching it now, having seen all of the TV episodes, it's quite fun to try and spot some of these lines that were either going to be used in future episodes or ones that were used in the first couple of series.
So. I'm told, actually, that in the first series that I wasn't even in, there was a sequence where the vicar is actually ringing his church bells, so I didn't even know that, but there you are, you get me actually see me doing it, so that was rather fun.
No, that's right, I think it was in the Battle for Godfrey's Cottage, Paul will correct me here if I'm wrong, where, yes, it's all off camera, because obviously there's been no vicar cast at that point,
no.
And they go back and kind of revisit that scenario, but this time we get to see you with the bells.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you were rewritten into the very early.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, there's always been a lot of rumours, and I'm not 100% certain as to how accurate these are. There was a lot of talk of a sequel, because this particular film had done quite well on the UK box office. Do you know much about that? Can you shed some light on that?
No, I can't shed any light at all. I wish there had been a sequel, because I would have been paid again. But I mean, I didn't even know about that. That's news to me. How wonderful. Yes, it would have been very good.
Yeah, there was a sequel planned, and this would involve more Germans and Mannering capture, very similar to Deadly Attachment, I think, and the platoon would have captured a submarine crew, I think it was going to be. John Gielgud, I think, wanted to be in it. I think some big names wanted to be in it, and were quite interested. And Jimmy Perry said that they didn't quite get the script right or something like that, or there wasn't the backing. But there was certainly interest from people to do it, financial probably not at the end of it, which is a shame, because I think it was going to be based in Wales or somewhere like that, away from Warmington, so frankly probably would have been in it anyway.
Oh, well, there we are. Well, it doesn't matter then. Don't they?
Unless you were right at the beginning, of course. But I think that Frank's quite lucky to actually be in the film, because when you think that Mrs. Pike wasn't cast, the original actress, that they could have really cast another vicar, couldn't they?
Indeed. We've had an email from a guy called Paul Thursden in Australia. Now, Paul knew we were going to speak to you this afternoon about the film and has sent me an email to ask you a question about the very thing Paul's just raised. Mrs. Pike was recast with Liz Fraser playing the role. So, I mean, do you feel that they shouldn't have done that?
Well, I think they certainly shouldn't have done that. I mean, I think Liz Fraser's a lovely lady and a lovely actress. I mean, nothing against Liz Fraser at all, but Mrs. Pike was Janet Davis. Janet Davis was Mrs. Pike. And I think to try and get a star name in it in that sort of way was a mistake. I mean, I really do think it was a big mistake. The fans all identified Janet Davis with Mrs. Pike, and to have Liz, lovely actress, lovely lady though she is, was a mistake. But I don't know. I mean, supposing I'd been replaced by John Gielgud, that would have been something wonderful, wouldn't it?
Yes. Well, was it the case Janet Davis wasn't available, though? We were assuming that Janet Davis wanted to do it and was able to do it, but it was...
I think she wasn't favoured. I think the same reason why she wasn't on the radio.
A lot of people weren't on the radio. I mean, I think... I don't think Pamela Condell did Mrs. Fox on the radio. Again, I was lucky to be in the radio series.
Molly Sutton.
But I do have a very distinctive voice, so I think on the radio it would have been very odd to have someone, unless they're a very good imitator of me, to do the vicar.
I think, let's just be clear, that John Gielgud wasn't going to be the vicar. I think John Gielgud would have been a Nazi. I think that was his...
goodness.
Yeah.
Going back to your time on set, Frank, what are your memories like of actually being filming in a slightly different set? The church hall, of course, is very different in the TV series.
Well, the church in the whenever we saw it in the television series was on the battle area near Thetford. The church in in the film was the church at the gates of Shepperton Studios, as I remember. And of course the sets like the Church Hall and so on were recreated in Shepperton Studios, and I don't think I was tremendously aware of it being that different. I mean, a church hall is a church hall is a church hall, and even my office is my office is my office.
Do you remember sneezing on Arthur Lowe's shoulder whilst you were squashed?
No, I've totally forgotten that. I mean, it is extraordinary how one does forget things. After nearly 40 years, isn't it now, when we started it. And it's 40 years since they started. I think it's almost 40 years since I first went into it. And it's extraordinary that one doesn't remember things. I mean, I sometimes see an episode is coming up on television. I think I'm going to look at that, but I wasn't in it. And then suddenly I turn up, and there I am. Amazing.
We were talking a long time ago, perhaps, but it's very interesting, certainly from a fan's point of view, to hear what an actor's experiences were like on set. And of course, at that point, you were no stranger to film sets. You've been in many, many other films. Does this particular film have anything different, or does it stand out in any way from your experiences in other films that you were in?
It was a very happy time, and I suppose I was in it rather more than I've been in some other films. I mean, quite often in some of the other films I've done, I've just gone in and done one cameo scene, as they say. Although others, some of the Norman Wisdom films I did, I mean, I did do quite a lot of. But I think the thing was, I mean, I'd already got to know the people in Dad's Army. I knew the cast, and so it was working with friends, which is always, and not just one or two friends, but a whole group of friends, which is always a great joy anyway.
And I'm sure that must have been quite a unique experience, really, when you're moving on from film to film, and you've been working with such a established group of people for a couple of series already.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely, it was. And I mean, I thought it was a great experience. I just feel the film itself lacks the pace of the television series. It has enormous charm, But it is in a way very different from the television series.
It is. It is certainly slower, as we touched on before. Yeah, but yeah. The film itself is, you can almost see its structure. It's almost three very different half-hour episodes. The first half an hour is establishing the local defence volunteers, then they become the Home Guard. Then you have the debacle at the training camp. And lastly, you have the finale. So it's almost as if you can see how it fits together. There are three parts, but yeah, somehow...
I have a feeling the training camp thing, I mean, obviously there's an episode which has part of that, but all that stuff about the horse floating down the river, that is unique to the film, I think.
Completely. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And also the confronting at the end of the Germans in the church hall is also completely unique to the film.
Oh, absolutely. It's not so much the content, it's the way it's been structured together.
But occasionally you get things like the van and so on, which are straight out of one of the episodes.
No, indeed, yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Frank, for sharing your experiences.
Pleasure.
What I'd like to do now is open up the discussion to everyone else who's been sitting here watching the film and listening. It's been said a lot of the time, war is very well depicted in Dad's Army. Now, this time you actually get to see the Germans rather than them being some kind of unseen menace or threat. Do you think that affects the atmosphere or the way the programme actually feels?
Well, you don't see too many Germans in the Dad's Army episodes, in the 80 episodes. You don't see them too many times, apart from perhaps Deadly Attachment and
a few early ones,
one
yeah.
or two others. One of the questions we had as we were watching the film was, can you actually see Britain from Germany using binoculars? I wonder, is it possible?
I think they were viewing it from France, weren't they? I think it was probably after the French occupation. So they were on the cliffs in France watching, I think. That's my view, I don't know.
I thought it was France, yes, but even then I think it's a bit of a stretch.
It's, what, 20 miles, something like that, across, 25 miles? It's possible.
What are you saying about the actual feel of war? I think there's a scene there where Godfrey is on his own, looking out with his little glasses. And I think that's the sort of thing that people were probably doing all over the South Coast, were looking out to see what's happening. And that very scene with that lone man on his own, the lovely scenery in the background, it just gives a sense of sort of menace, I think, that it's just so lovely, and you've got this... You know, one old person looking out over the sea, what's he going to do if anything happened? But that was probably what people were like. They don't know where, when.
Personally, I think the film depicted the Nazis and Germans in a very different way to how you see them in the TV series. Is it important to watch the film in a context of not having seen any of the TV series? I mean, would you have a completely different experience of these characters if you hadn't seen Dad's Army before and you'd gone to see this film at the cinema?
Controversy time. I really liked the film. And I liked it as a film because the film is a very different media to television. And it was able to do some things that aren't easily done, I don't think, on television or wouldn't have been then. For example, we were seeing the Nazis with their invasion plans and at the end. He said something like, "The Führer wants to see your invasion plans, please deliver them." And then they cut straight to Mannering. And he was told, "Oh, your wife says, please bring the Brussels sprouts to them." And I think on one level that's really funny. And yes, but also it illustrates the wartime situation and the disparity between the two sides. But very difficult, I think, to do that on a TV budget as easily cut like that. Especially with the more sort of, given present company, I'd have to be very careful about how I put this, but the sort of the feeling that the TV gives that the sets are going to fall apart and they're a bit sort of knockabout farcical. You couldn't do that on a TV thing.
Well, I think the film's a lot bigger all round, really. The sets, I mean, the German headquarters, you see the whole hallway. You could never do that on a television, budget. And that was actually filmed at Chiswick House, so it's not really German. Even the scenery, the use of helicopter for the sequences where they actually pan over the whole scenery, the beginning with the car, and even using that whole street, like Chalfont St Giles, actually showing the town. Whereas you got snippets before on location in Thetford and wherever, but you never got the whole picture of the town in one shot. ever, including the bank, external to the bank. Makes it so much bigger, I think.
I think it adds to the reality of it as well. I mean, it's much more believable. You see extras walking down the street as well, so it just makes it feel that much more genuine.
Plus the use of music. Claire commented on the music in the background, which you never got, obviously, in the TV series in the background. So that does make it a bigger production, I think, as well.
Although there were distinct sections in it, there were some very nice tie-ins that, again, you wouldn't have over the length of an episode. You could only have over 90 minutes. For example, it's that damn bank clock. It kept being there, And it was really elegant the way the beginning scene, the Germans and the coast, goes back right at the end, and it ties up very neatly to the Germans and the coast. And again, you probably wouldn't do all of that and the big shots. And secondly, there was another really good point I was about to make, and I'm sure I will remember it in just a few seconds. Yes. You were talking about the piece with the van and the gas and all of that. And I haven't actually seen one of the episodes where that is, although I absolutely take your word for it, it's there. From my point of view, it's a bit predictable, but it was funny. The reason I'm guessing the writers put it in there, and I'm just guessing, maybe Frank actually knows, but the reason I'm guessing they put it there is because it's a standalone film. You have to assume that somebody going there might not have ever seen the TV thing. And for my money, what that shows is, again, and I know I'm a bit addressed by this, but the relationship between Mannering and Wilson is so wonderful. Wilson has his whole marching force and they're all beautifully together and they're doing it right. And then Mannering comes in and just cocks it all up. It's a gas, really.
The episode with the van being converted to gas was actually Frank's first episode in the TV series, and that was The Armoured Might of Lots, Corporal Jones.
My very first episode.
It was indeed.
I think I only had two lines where I said, yes, you could take the gas out of the vicarage.
I think they were nicking it anyway.
Well, I thought the... just to come back to that point of the cinematic quality and whether it's got to be different for... it's got to be for a first-time audience or not, I think they hedged their bets to a certain extent with the film version, where it was designed to appeal to those who'd seen the TV series and those who hadn't. They had to appeal to both markets, really. And I think they did. I think the way the scene setting was done, to start with, was brief, but not too brief. And you got some good points from Wilson. You got, early on, a very good feel for the relationship between Wilson and Mannering. And that was some very deft writing, I thought. There were some very quick lines, some quick exchanges, which established the relationship very fast. But it wouldn't have alienated somebody who already knew it from the TV series. So that was very skillfully done.
How much do you think the absence of a laughter track, you know, how much of an impact do you feel that had?
Well, perhaps it may have had the effect of slowing, making it feel slower, because there wasn't that laughter to fill up the extra space.
Well, when I saw it at the cinema, when it came out, it was a laughter track. It's called The Audience. So there is a laughter. When you watch films on television, they aren't not meant to be watched on television. They're meant to be seen in the theatre with other people reacting to it. So you get your built-in laughter track. If you watched a TV episode in the cinema with a laughter track, that would sound really weird, wouldn't it? Watching a film with a laughter track built in. So it's fine without laughter track.
I think that's a very good point, actually. I mean, I think... the fact that we do sort of get used to having a laughter track on a television series, when you watch a film on television, you have to recognise that you're watching a film, you're not watching a TV, you're not watching something that's been done in front of a live audience, and so it is going to be different. And I do think, in a way, trying to stand back objectively, I think the film probably does stand on its own as a film, whether you've seen the TV series or not. And I think if you'd seen it in total isolation from the TV series, you probably would think, yes, this is really a rather good a good film.
Mm. I went, and it was busy. I think it was during school holidays and stuff like that.
Oh, you're so young.
I am. But I also remember buying the cigarette cards, and I didn't collect the whole set, but I can remember there was some sort of tie-in, which is was unusual, I suppose, for the time, but you got the cigarette cards and you could actually see the pictures of the film before you went to see it, so you knew some of the scenes were coming up.
Really? We were on cigarette cards, weren't we?
We were. Well, you were, sorry. You were.
Well, there we are. I didn't know that.
I'll have to get you a set.
Well, good, thank you.
I mean, how much did we miss some of the semi-regulars in this film? Captain Square, of course, wasn't there, and he featured in the very early episodes of Dad's Army.
Well, I think a lot of the regulars were there, but not in the characters that were in Dad's Army. Mm. We had Robert Ragland at the end as the police sergeant, or at the end. Michael Knowles as the normal sidekick, and I think Pat Coombs, he was on the radio episode as well. John D. Collins was in it right at the end as well. He was a regular, certainly on Hello, Hello, latterly, as one of the British airmen. But he was in Dad's Army a few times, I think. And a couple of others I probably saw. But
did we actually ever see Pat Coombs in the television series?
No.
I can't remember.
I think she was in the radio episode.
Yeah, she was in the radio, but I just... I mean, you know, so many people were in episodes I wasn't in that I wondered if Pat was, but...
The good thing is that the actual supporting cast, the back row of the platoon, they're all regulars. They didn't replace the Colin Beans and George Hancocks with anyone. They could have replaced all of them with anyone they wanted, couldn't they, really? Who was to know? They weren't speaking parts. Mm. But, I mean, good on them. They replaced them with the familiar faces in the background. And if you've seen the episode, you know, if you're into it, you know they're the same platoon members. They didn't muck about the platoon members.
And I think, actually, two of them are referred to as Private Hastings and Private Hancock, aren't they?
In the TV show, yes. Not in the film, I don't think.
I thought they were.
No, might have been one.
Well, I thought I'll caught that today.
You might caught one.
Should we watch it again quickly?
Watch it again. I stand corrected.
Very quickly. What performances do you think stand out? Any of the regular cast or any of the guest cast at all?
Well, Frank mentioned that Jones is truncated, for one. And there's a bit of slapstick from him, but there's not so much in the way of speaking.
I thought Clive Dunn portrayed Jones far more in line with the way he portrayed him in the first two series, in the black and white episodes. He came across as a much older Jones than he did later on in the TV episodes. And Jones is one character, as everyone knows, I'm not particularly keen on usually, whereas I thought he was... Frank's given me a very quizzical look there. I can give you a very long story and explanation but to that later on.
Okay.
It's not that I don't like him, it's just that I don't like him as much as the other characters. But I found him quite tolerable, and he wasn't so potty in this story. In fact, it was actually Corporal Jones' idea at the end to go in dressed as the choir. He suggested that to Mannerin when they were all in the graveyard. So one of his suggestions was actually quite sensible, I think.
I've seen it for a long time, and I suddenly saw Pat Coombs, and I thought that was a lovely little moment with her. She's that fun.
Well, it's funny because I think at that point I asked Paul whether or not Pamela had been cast as Mrs. Fox, because I wondered whether or not that role would have normally have gone to Pamela, whether or not Pat Coombs was cast instead. But apparently that wasn't the case, was it?
I don't think so. I think Pam was ever considered for the...
No, well, I mean, it was just Lady in the Queue, wasn't it?
She
wasn't Mrs. Fox. And I think Pat was... something of a name like Liz Fraser. So, I mean, people at that time did have this great thing of getting well-known names in to play smallish parts, and then you could build them, and you could say, Liz Fraser's in this film, Pat Coombs is in this film, and sometimes, you know, you blink and you miss them, but, I mean, there they were, and they probably brought people into the cinema.
Looking at the story, then, and how the characters react somewhat, Mannerin's portrayed as much more bungling in the film than he is in the series, I think. And he's been given quite a hard time by his superior officer, whereas I think Colonel Pritchard in the series actually thinks Mannerin's quite efficient. I mean, how do you think that came across? Did they go too far with making Mannerin look silly at times?
No. Is the superior in the film, is that the man who keeps saying, damn bank clerk?
That's the one. That's
okay.
The one. Oh, General Fullard.
I think they do that quite well. They do that quite well where Mannering at the start refuses to cash this gentleman's cheque, only to find out later on that he's his manager, basically. Which I think can happen in real life a few times. You can find yourself being rude to people who end up being your boss some years later.
I think that really can happen.
So I like the way it was done. And Mannering being shown up in either the episodes or the film is always quite good.
We used to have a member of the society who was obsessed with Bernard Archer and his role in putting down Mannering. And he used to write and write to a chap who ran it before we did, Jack, before he died, and he used to write letters and letters and letters because he loved this person, how he put down Mannering, and he was obsessed.
Yeah.
Really obsessed with him, yeah.
It's incredible to certain aspects of a production or an episode that individuals either remember or really enjoy concentrating on. This movie is probably most seen at Christmas time. Now, is there a particular reason for that, do you think?
It's probably cheap, what, hour and a half to show at Christmas, I suppose. It's the same as on the buses and Steptoe. They show the tie-ins. It's just a normal thing you get at Christmas and Easter. I mean, I remember Dad's Army was on last Easter. It was on this Christmas. So it gets quite a few airings, I think. There's nothing wrong with that. It's safe entertainment. Anyone can watch it. And I think that's a good thing for the afternoon slot, really. Or even early evening. It's much the same as the programme itself. Steptoe, probably not so. But obviously Dad's Army, it's good, solid entertainment.
Claire, I'd like to come back to you if I can quickly. I mean, as an inexperienced Dad's Army fan, if you like, can I go as far as putting you a fan yet? Or
Dad's Army neophyte is probably.
Thank you very much. We have Claire on here for the long words.
I'm just being honest. Okay, I'm a rookie.
A rookie, okay. What parts of this film did you really enjoy?
I enjoyed, as ever, all parts with Wilson in it, because I think he's just superb. And I actually think he responded better to film, because he's got the kind of face that only has to do a very slight movement, and it's registered, and that's what happens with a film camera, isn't it? As I understand it, Frank. So be careful, I've got Frank sitting next to me. Check everything with it. Actually, I'm halfway through, I actually, for a joke, I wrote down what I thought was going to happen at the end. And I wrote down something along the lines of, I think that Mannering's men will save the day and somehow defeat the Germans, but totally by accident. And actually, the way it was written, I should have given them more credit, because it certainly wasn't by accident. And there's actually quite a bravery and a lion-heartedness, and I liked that aspect to it. I like the fact that they were able to blend together so many more stories than you can in a half-hour episode. And for me, even though it may not have been faster, it made it slicker. And so rather than pick up particular bits, although there was a rather nice joke about you can have my privates anytime or something like that, which I did love, always like that kind of thing. But rather than picking up individual bits, I think it's the themes and the tenor and the relationships that I really did like.
Can I just come in on that? Because I do totally agree about John Lemaire, who was my absolute favourite person in the whole thing, because he was such a lovely man. But that wonderfully understated, laid-back thing, which a film camera can catch in a close-up, is absolutely marvellous. The other thing which Claire picked up on, which I think is absolutely right, it does show that Mannering is a brave man. And he is and that's the thing that is really very important, I think, about Dad's Army, that people have criticised it for saying, you know, you're making fun of somebody that was really quite serious. But actually, if you look at Mannering is a man who really cares about his country, who really would die for his country. And that comes over in the film very well indeed, and I think that's marvellous.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I think it probably comes across more so in the film, particularly in the last few scenes, than a lot of the TV series, because you only get flashes of how patriotic and how brave he is within the series. But
I mean, there's a nice one in one of the episodes where the grenade and the regular army are saying, no, we're not going to do anything about that, and Mannering rushes forward and gets the grenade to stop it blowing up the power station. And Mannering is a man of great, great courage. And I think, you know, that was true. That's a truth. And I think it's good that the series portrays that and the film portrays it.
No, I think it also shows the depth of writing talent that you can... Mm. I mean, most people will associate the word pompous or proud or stubborn with Mannering. And yet, those who have seen pretty much every episode get to see that the underlying depth of the character and the commitment and the way that he feels about his country. And that's almost... Well, one, it's used to great comic effect. And two, it really does show Arthur Lowe's range of acting skills to portray a character with so many different layers.
Yeah, we just had two. Well, no, I was going to say two. We had three wonderful people at the top of the thing. I mean, Arthur and John. Watching Arthur and John doing a scene together was a real, real joy because they just had wonderful timing and the contrast. And John's wonderful, is that really wise, laid-back thing. And it's so wonderful as a foil for Mannering's thing. But deep down, Mannering loves his country and will... And they all will. I mean, that scene with Arnold, I mean, standing on the clifftop, you know, there he is with his opera glasses, but if the Germans came, he'd do his best to do something about them.
No, absolutely. And I think that's the real strength. I think that's the real strength of Dad's Army, is to mesh comedy with other elements and other aspects and other genres at times. And some of the most fondly remembered TV episodes are those that are a little bit more dramatic than comedic. Mm. You look at Mum's Army. So, but anyway, I'm moving well off point here, Paul.
what is missing from the film is the conflict between Mannering and the vicar, and of course Mannering and the warden. I assume there wasn't enough space in the film to put that conflict in. There is conflict, and that's between him and Colonel Fullard. So I suppose that one element replaced the conflict between the vicar and the warden.
We do just have that slight thing where I say it's my office, but then I go in and I really am not very thing about it. I sneeze over it, which is not really a great thing to do.
It's more of a running gag, I think, between the two of them. And you get the ARP wanting their hall, and it's finished there. Obviously, the vicar's upset that he's using his office. And that's it. It's finished there, isn't it, really?
But in the TV series, there was a very real thing. It was the platoon against the vicar versus the warden.
And what happened is the warden and the vicar replaced Hitler as Mannering's...
I think we probably did, yes. Yeah, people all of us had a fat man over the channel. Yeah.
You had to have a go at somebody. So I presume that those two characters replaced the threat, really, from afar.
There's that time when Wilson is listening to the radio and Mannering comes into the office and the radio's tuned to a Lord Haw Haw.
That's right, yeah.
And Wilson says that it's the vicar was listening to it or something. So I was wondering, is the vicar in Dad's Army a supporter of the Germans?
Certainly not. No. Certainly not.
What a question. No, I remember. It's certainly implied in the TV series at that point. And there's also...
I didn't even know that. What is this episode? I was watching it.
Which episode? I can't... Oh.
That's a good question. Can you remember, Paul?
Not off the top of my head.
If Paul can't remember...
I listened to Lord Haw Haw.
I think... Have I got that right?
Yeah,
well,
you're right.
You probably have, yes.
Absolutely.
I don't think it's an episode I'm in, because I don't remember listening to Lord Haw Haw.
No, it's a question of... No, I suppose it's putting the episode as a question of know thine enemy. Sort of, you want to know what the enemy are up to, so you listen to Lord Haw Haw.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah.
We've just been extolling Mannering's virtues, but perhaps he's overly suspicious of the vicar for no good reason.
Well, I mean, who wouldn't be? I mean, I really have a pain in his whatever.
One of the other things that I've wanted to mention, it doesn't really have a significant amount to do with the film, but certainly if we're talking about the secret life of the vicar, it's implied in other episodes also that he likes the odd tipple.
The vicar is a martyr to the whiskey, I think, was Mr. Sinclair's little contribution. When I asked Mannering for a double whiskey, he said, better make it a single. The vicar is a martyr to the whiskey. I think I probably did like the odd tipple, and why not?
Absolutely.
And I still do.
I've got a question here. Perhaps it's a reflection of the TV series, but how come we didn't see more of Hodges? We don't see that much of him.
There wasn't the space to put a story in or a line where Hodges has the conflict with Mannering at all.
There are times in the film where you do sort of feel, particularly with Hodges, I think, that we've got to get Hodges in somewhere, so give him a little something to do here. In a funny way, the vicar does have a sort of relevance to the story, because he's there ringing his bells and he's there in the church hall when the Germans come in. And I was amazed, I mean, I'd forgotten this, but Teddy Sinclair, the verger, doesn't come on to right at the end, does he?
No, I think out of all of the supporting roles, you mentioned earlier there was a team, yourself, the verger and the warden, that you certainly had the most prominent role.
Yeah, which, no, I mean, I don't know why, but it would really quite nice if I did.
No, and the vicar was central to the plot, as you say. I think Hodges, although his appearance was very fleeting, he was the one who alerted the authorities that the Germans had taken over the hall, though. So he had quite an important function.
But quite unnecessarily, because Mannering had got it in control anyway.
Yes, but he heard the gunshot, didn't he? Yeah. Which I also thought was interesting, given that at the very end of the film, Mannering and Wilson exchange a few lines about how the Germans' guns were empty. And if that was the case, then the German used his last bullet by shooting it into the church roof.
Presumably, yes, absolutely. I don't think you need to go into that kind of analysis of the script, or maybe it won't work.
Oh, James does.
Trust me, that's nothing. We've got into far, far greater detail than that.
One more question I just want to put through the group. Do you notice the way that the Nazis are always referred to as the Nazis and not the Germans, and yet surely folks of that period would refer to the Germans and not the Nazis? Was that the scriptwriters being careful, looking at one eye on the German market, or...? Because the word Nazis appears all the time. Mm. The word Germans hardly ever gets used. Mannering refers to a shabby Nazi trick, then later on somebody else refers to the Nazis and not the Germans.
I mean, I was a mere child at the time, but I have a feeling anything German, and it was the word German that was unacceptable. Mm. Oh, God, what's happening when this thing goes out? I mean, I'm not saying anything against the German nation, but I do think... During the war, people did talk about the Germans. The Germans did this, the Germans did that. And I think you may well be right that it is a conscious, and quite right in a way, thing not to offend the German nation, but to make sure clear that we are not talking about the German nation the whole, we're talking about the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And I think that is right and proper. But I think that's probably a conscious decision, which probably not entirely historically accurate. Mm. Mm. I don't know, but as I say, I was only about 7 or 8 at the time, so how would I know?
And for the scriptwriters, they always have to play fast and loose with certain elements just to create a film. Hitchcock said that film is life with the dull bits taken out. Things have to be changed to make a good film, basically.
Yes.
It's always a question of striking that balance. And it wasn't that noticeable anyway, it's just something I picked up on.
Well, right at the end of the film, it's the normality I like, where everything's almost peaceful. It's as though there's no war, and when Mannering is obviously he's walking down the street, bumping into the same people, meets the same people every day. It's just back to normality, even though there's a war on. Mm.
And I think that, going back to Claire's point, that was a thing that was the strength of the film, that you were actually able to top and tail certain things. I mean, I think it's a thing of real filmic thing, that you do get the general at the beginning being refused to cash the cheque and then turning out. And as you've just said, that sort of complementary two scenes, one at the beginning and one at the end, which complement each other, and they're all about Britain just getting on with life. One, when it's all going to start being difficult because the Home Guard, and later when it's coming, well, the film is coming to an end.
But in the middle of that, you get, obviously, a view of the street with the army going through, which...
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, something else about the film, as a film, is that you've got an excellent sense of mise-en-scene. The make-up of the scene is splendid. We've mentioned it before, where Mannering is shoved against the wall with Fraser one side and the vicar the other, and both the vicar and the Fraser are effectively framing Mannering, and they're both interjecting into the scene in a humorous way. So that whole thing works together very nicely, the whole mise-en-scene comes together. And that's something you don't get on TV so much.
Yeah, you've
that's
got to say what that means.
Is it putting into place? I'm just guessing.
Oh. Mise-en-scene is, the way the scene is structured, the look of the scene.
But there's no reason why you shouldn't get it on television. I mean, I don't think that particularly filmic. But what I do think is filmic is, as various people have said, the fact you do see the entire street. And thinking back to Thetford, I don't think there's an equivalent street in Thetford that looks period that you could do it in. So the fact that it was in Chalfont St Giles gave an opportunity to do something you couldn't do on the television scene.
No, certainly. In Thetford, there are certain locations that stick in the mind, but I don't think there was ever wide shots or used for a high street. No.
Well, I don't think there is a high street in Thetford that you could do that with that looks, that still looks as though it could be in 19,
in the 1940s.
You mentioned the when you walked around looking at the shops when we first got there, looking at the dressing in the shops. If you went to Chalfont St Giles today, the butcher's hasn't changed a bit. It's exactly the same as it is in the fair. That wasn't dressed at all. That was how it was, and that's how it still is. And the greengrocer's as well. It hasn't changed. Yeah. Mm.
Paul, you've visited a lot of the locations used in this film, haven't you? I mean, how do they compare today? Certainly the lot of country shots.
Well, certainly. The Shepperton lot, that's obviously the same. The reservoir where they did the crushing with the roller, that's still there. That hasn't changed a bit. The church is still there, exactly the same. That statue you see with the angel with the head down, I thought that was a prop, but when I went there, that is a real memorial. And of course, they all copied it, which was quite a nice touch, I thought. So the church is still there. I'm not sure where the vicar's house was that he popped out where they drove across the lawn. I don't know where that was.
I think that was somewhere in the grounds of Shepperton Studios. I'm not sure, but I think it was.
The rest of it was filmed at Seaford, the coast. Was not far from Brighton, and the scene with the horse going down the river, that was at Cookham, which is in Maidenhead,
right.
And all the scenes along the riverbank filmed there as well.
Was that the actual Thames then? Was that the end of the Thames?
Yeah, in the Thames, yeah, Cookham Lock. Mm-hmm. And what was the other bit? Where they're marching down the street, where you actually see the shadow of the camera, where they're in their long johns, that's at Cobham, and that has changed a lot, because where they do the disembarking with the cat with the van, that car park's completely grown. You can't see, it's all the trees are huge now, and that's completely changed. So, if you look around, you have to bear in mind that these places are different if you're going to look for them.
The one that Paul's not mentioning is the opening scene with Godfrey using the lavatory. And while we're watching the film earlier on, Paul just leans over and says, "Is that lavatory?" He says, "The base is still there."
Well, if it is, then that's great. But that wasn't Dover either, was it?
It's Seaford.
No, and was that used for the shots where we see the Germans on top of the cliffs as well?
Exactly the same, yes. When you see the car driving up right at the very beginning, that's the bumpy road from the Seaford car park to the cliff edge.
That again, that ties in with your point about how there is the comparison with the Nazis with us, with the Home Guard. And it, again, establishes that link to have the Nazis on a very similar cliff face to the Home Guard.
No, indeed. And I think that, as you said, we don't see that so much in a TV series. What we do see in a TV series in terms of direction is a lot of reaction humour. Mm-hmm. In fact, all of the classic moments have nearly always got a reaction shot. That didn't happen so much in a film, and it's the first time I've noticed
that. You can't do it. No. I don't think you can do it on film. It's too much time wasted, isn't there, as looking at somebody. If you've got an audience laughing, I think that fills the gap of the reaction shot. If you've just got somebody looking at the camera and nothing happening, even though there's... How do you cut it? How do you time it?
It's chicken and egg, isn't it? Which came first, the reaction shot or the laughter track? I suppose the reaction shot filled the laughter track.
Well, I mean, I think David Croft was an absolute master of editing and cutting and going into reaction shots. I mean, a lot of the stuff I talked about with Clive Dunway going on to these rambling stories, half the joy of it is cutting to Arthur's face in the middle of it, going, you know, raising his eyebrows and sort of saying, oh, gosh, how much longer is this going to go on? And I mean... I suppose you're quite right. It's very difficult to do that and time that in film, so it doesn't happen. And that, I think, is a lack in the film.
And I think it's also responsible for one of the things we said right at the very beginning and how different the film feels. And I think because the reaction humour is so central to the TV series, it's absent. It's absent from the film.
Yeah.
So they've had to rely on other things instead.
Yeah. I was just thinking that reaction shots and laughter tracks... For me, and especially laughter tracks, but tend to say, well, this is where you're supposed to laugh, so please laugh now. that gets me just on principle, because I like to be able to choose where I'm going to laugh. And I get that the reaction shots, I'll compromise on them, but the laughter track, no, not at all.
Well, certainly laughter tracks on the programme had to be faded out, because they were so long, the laughter, that it covering up the next piece of dialogue. And even in the external shots on location, they don't know how long people are going to laugh for. So, editing, and how long do they pause for? How long do they, when their next line is? Because when actually with the audience in front of them, they can time the next line, can't they?
Yeah.
You can't do that in a location. No. So you'll find that you'll hear the laughter track fading out so they can get the next line in.
Yeah, I have noticed that in the past, although perhaps not consciously, but now that you mention it, I can certainly think at times, yeah.
And also, on there's some, it's the one where Mandarin gets taken away. Oh, David Bloomberg grows up, your favourite episode. When they're on the bridge at the end.
Oh, right.
And when they actually pull in Mandarin from the... After
oh, the barrage balloon one.
That actual scene gets a round of applause.
Yeah.
Which has had to be cut because there's dialogue.
Yeah.
If you listen. So, yeah, it's a shame.
How different is it, Frank, when you're either filming on location or when you're filming the film, where you come up with a line that you know is going to get a laugh, but you don't hear it? I mean, how difficult is that?
I don't know. I mean, I think you go into a different mode of acting. I mean, if you're doing location filming or filming, you know you're doing that. If you're working in a thing in front of a television audience, you know the audience is there, you hear the audience is there, and you then time things slightly differently because of the reaction from the audience. Mm. Doing a television in front of a live audience is sort of midway between doing a film and doing a piece of theatre, and you have to sort of try and adapt to that. Mm. But when you're doing film, obviously, you can't. I mean, sometimes the director will say, that's going to get a big laugh there, so can you pause? Or, I'm going to cut there, hold it as long as you like, but I'm going to cut there, and then I can judge how long I need to leave for a laugh. But, I mean, it's a bit of a dicey thing, because sometimes you think you're delivering a wonderfully funny line and you need to be totally silence in the theatre. So there we are.
Do you have more? Is there more adrenaline in front of the audience than making a film?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it depends. On a fairly relaxed film like that, yes, certainly much less adrenaline than would be in doing a live television. Well, of course, it wasn't live, it was recorded, but I mean, I go back to the days of live television.
Yeah, the Army Game, yeah.
Yeah, the Army Game, which was total live all the time, and that was adrenaline like it was going out of fashion. I mean, just like a first night in the theatre, which can be terrifying. But going to theatre, I mean, you can sort of suddenly be taken totally by surprise with a comedy line. I can remember doing an Eightbourne play and saying a line which I never even thought was funny. And on the first night, I mean, it just got such a belter of a laugh that I was totally taken by surprise. And, you know, one had to wait for quite a long time, pause to get let this laugh work itself. And I think the same is true of doing television in front of a live audience. But film, of course, you don't do that. So you have to rely on the director, in a sense, to do the editing in a way to leave room for a laugh if he feels there's going to be one there. And good luck to him.
OK, just to close now, we've been talking for the best part of an hour or thereabouts. I'd like to just go around quickly and just get your final thoughts, your overall thoughts on the film, and perhaps... can you give it a rating, let's say out of 10 this time, because it's a film, it's three times as long.
I still prefer the episodes, but I won't slate the film any longer. I actually quite enjoyed it, and I think probably partly enjoyed it because of someone who's sitting with us watching it. But
it's always fun watching it with Paul.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I'll give it 7.
I think it's a good film. I always enjoy watching it, but I think it's far more atmospheric and larger than the TV show, and I think the two do sit slightly separately. Out of 10, I'll probably give it 7.
I'd go for 7. I'd look at it as a film on its own merits, and I would remove it from the TV series. I think that's the best way to view it, to be honest. Come at it as a totally separate entity, because as we've discussed, it is a film. It's made for a different viewing experience than the TV show. So view it separately. Compared with the films of its time, well, 71, I mean, there's a lot of very different films around then, so it must have felt like almost like a breath of fresh air, given some of the other stuff, like French Connection or Get Cast or The Last Picture Show, all of which were 71. So it must have really stood out. It was possibly why it did really well at the box office. Mm. Good work, why. Either way, it's rather a success. I'd give it a 7, and I probably would buy it on DVD, but I'd definitely buy it on DVD. We had a commentary from Paul and Frank, and that would be really very good going forward.
Well, anybody still around, if
yeah.
There you go.
I think I'd give it 7 or 8 out of 10. I mean, there were a lot of films at that time that were spin-offs from television shows, and a lot of them, let's be honest, were quite dire. This, I think, was really quite a good example of one. Mm. I think it's probably better if you view it without knowing the TV series, because it is very different from the TV series and works in its own right. But I think it has enormous charm, it has enormous atmosphere, and I think it's got a lot going for it. And I think, yeah, at least 7, probably 8 out of 10.
At risk of sounding really boring and not having been paid to say this, apart from the pizza afterwards, of course, 7 or 8 out of 10, just as a film on its merits. Really enjoyed it. You've got men dancing around in their long johns. What's not to like? But 7 or 8 out of 10. Also had the privilege of watching this with Frank, and Frank, you can ring my bells anytime.
Oh, I do apologise for that joke there. But
I had to say it.
Don't apologise, thank you.
It just leaves me then. I'll give it a highly original 8 out of 10 as well. I've always enjoyed the film, and I've enjoyed it whilst being a fan of the TV episodes as well. I enjoy it in a completely different way, but I enjoy seeing the actors being placed in a more grounded and almost more real setting because of the budget and of the genuine feel of the use of Chalfour St Giles. And yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. So 8 out of 10 for me. All that leaves is for me to thank all 5 of our guests today. So thank you ever so much for taking part in this discussion. And Frank, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Your views and insights have been incredibly interesting. And hope we can do it again at some point.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Thank you, everyone. Goodbye.
He's ready with his gun. So who do you think?